Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
back. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and this is another edition of Pan African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, April the 4th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from studios in downtown Detroit. Let's thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan African Journal. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan African News Report. Have dispatches on the talks underway between Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt in efforts to resolve the disagreements surrounding the Grand Renaissance Dam project. Kenya says that it needs additional supplies of AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine from the company, the Serum Institute. An attack on two Somali military bases has resulted in numerous casualties. And the Egyptians have held a motorcade of pharaohs to mark the opening of a new museum chronicling the ancient history of the North African state. In the second and third hours, we'll be back on the third anniversary of the martyrdom of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We listened to an audio files from a few of the last addresses, as well as archived reports around the assassination and its aftermath in the United States. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program this week.
ngaina lukra kilinyo ngaina pikao Zua zua ele kangana kwa ya tapi Mwaenda la muka tena kwa ya tefe Naningina zite sano salamu Ngaina zua teo ngaina pikao
Thank you.
po moto na yo oyo na kolingaka mama na jamisha kanisa na no mwana nani ya kovatela kako yo kela yo ne kunya solo na molato na moto na lingaka
oya.
Thank you.
pie mwana mama oyeba. Mosala oyonza komba pone langa. Susuna kontika te. Pichengo biamo kili piko sila katere. Ebuma mama na nikoro. Kavango, Kaina bango bomba na seka titi na nini bako landa kamuve mwana ngai Soso ngai mwana bato bako boma ngai pamba Tina yeli kambona koe bate Na mwana komi kambi kambona mesa na seko loba Nukina suali boma Ebola la kipino la verite na ngai Na ebi uta ye kose meleka Paluka kaye na polingo wo Yango basu ambala jako tumora ngai mai Bakoluka bakabula piso Kala mopali oyo Sosili solingana Ebandeli ya ngai na uta mama Bolingo pona yo ekoma bombo Konga tena zali mwana moto Topo ya na tehe Mote mananga ikaka seyo Nalinga kayo Nibala ya bana seko kondila
yo soma kambogo nandi mi pwale nganda lingi yo joke ke sala eloko yoko emege ngai mwana motogo gogande na la vigi motema diona siporte nyonso makambogo nandimi pwale mpo na lingi kaka yogo
lele
yesino luntimba
ebayala lele
makamilo nzakuntimba
ebayala lele
yete diluntimba
ebayala lele
serpanta kuntimba
ebayala lele
mopole ediluntimba
ebayala lele
yameringo luntimba
ebayala lele
makirimbia nzaluntimba
ebayala lele
Luntimba,
Ebayala lele,
Bokiswa de la Reluntimba,
Ebayala lele,
Bisoma Molaka Luntimba,
Ebayala lele,
Banaya Continental,
Ebayala lele,
Edition Musicana,
Ebayala lele.
comprend à tout naïe, papier. N'assemble qui chante à Jili Matete. N'a mon aïeux, c'est un gros bolingo, n'a gaïe, palé, l'oïo, naïe, bisaïo. Ocolu, casse, ma tata, n'a li pala. Oye, pina, malamou, n'a poye, qui yo, mon pali, goyo, mon sangui, singa.
Yeah. Mr. Storer, Mr. McWilliams, other distinguished platform guests, ladies and gentlemen. I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to have the privilege of being a part of this very significant conference. And in the very beginning, I want to express my deep personal appreciation to my friend Robert Vaughn for these very kind and gracious words of introduction. It's always good to be in California and to renew old friendships and fellowships, and I'm happy to share the platform with friends that I've known all along. I see Jack Tenner is here with us today, and he's been a great supporter of our work in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You know, he's a great fundraiser, and one evening, we were having a fundraising meeting at the home of Bert Lancaster, and when he got to making the appeal, my associate Ralph Abernathy said, "You sound like a good Baptist preacher." So whenever he talks to you about money, you better hold your pocketbook very closely. But we're happy to be here with all of these friends. And of course, whenever I come to California, particularly when I take the flight out of New York or Chicago, I'm always happy to get on the ground because the flight over the Rockies, you know, is usually very turbulent. And after a turbulent flight, I am always happy to land. And I don't want to give anybody here the impression that I don't have faith in God in the air. It's simply that I've had more experience with him on the ground. Let me say briefly how happy I am to be here under the auspices of Nation Magazine. Through its journalistic integrity and its genuine liberalism, certainly this magazine has carved for itself an imperishable niche in the annals of journalistic history in our nation. And I know those of us who are readers and subscribers of Nation Magazine are deeply indebted to it for all that it has done to make the discussion of the vital issues of our day and our age a reality. I think we can all say, I'm sure Nation would appreciate that applause you're about to give. And certainly in these days of emotional tension, when the problems of the world are gigantic in extent and chaotic in detail, that is no greater need than for sober thinking, healthy debate, creative dissent, and enlightened discussion. And I think this is why this particular symposium is so important. And so this afternoon I would like to speak to you candidly and I hope forthrightly about our present involvement in Vietnam. And I have chosen as a subject from which to speak the casualties of the war in Vietnam. We are certainly all aware of the nightmarish physical casualties of this war. We see them in our living rooms in all of their tragic dimensions on television screens. And we read about them on our subway and bus rides in daily newspaper accounts. We see the rice fields of a small Asian country being trampled at will and burned at whim. We see grief-stricken mothers with crying babies clutched tightly in their arms as they watched their little huts burst forth into flames. We see the fields and valleys of battle being painted with humankind's blood. We see the broken bodies left prostrate in countless fields. Most tragic of all is the casualty list among children. It is estimated that some 1 million Vietnamese children have been casualties of this brutal war, a war in which children are incinerated by napalm, in which American soldiers die in mounting numbers, while other American soldiers, according to press accounts, in unrestrained hatred, shoot the wounded enemy as they lie on the ground. It is a war that mutilates the conscience. These casualties are enough to cause all men to rise up with righteous indignation and oppose the very nature of this evil war. But the physical casualties of the war in Vietnam are not alone the catastrophes. The casualties of principles and values are equally disastrous and injurious. If the casualties of principle are not healed, the physical casualties will continue to mount. One of the first casualties of the war in Vietnam was the Charter of the United Nations. In taking armed action against the Viet Cong and North Vietnam, the United States clearly violated the UN Charter, which provides in Chapter 1, Article 2, that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. And in Chapter 7, it states that the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and shall make recommendations or shall decide what measures shall be taken to maintain or restore international peace and security. It is very obvious that our government blatantly violated its obligation under the Charter of the UN to submit to the Security Council its charge of aggression against North Vietnam. Instead, we unilaterally launched an all-out war on Asian soil. In the process, we have undermined the purpose of the UN and caused its effectiveness at many points to atrophy. We have also placed our nation in the position of being morally and politically isolated. Even the long-standing allies of America have adamantly refused to join our government in this ugly war. As Americans and lovers of democracy, we should carefully ponder the consequence of our nation's declining moral status in the world. The second casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of self-determination. By entering a war that is little more than a domestic civil war, America has ended up supporting a new form of colonialism covered up by certain niceties of complexity. Whether we realize it or not, our participation in the war in Vietnam is an ominous expression of our lack of sympathy for the oppressed, our paranoid anti-communism, our failure to feel the ache and anguish of the have-nots. It reveals our willingness to continue participation in neo-colonialist adventures. A brief look at the background and history of this war reveals with brutal clarity the ugliness of our policy. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after the combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by the now well-known Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of her former colony. President Truman felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence. And we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese people have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war costs. Even before the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they began to despair of their reckless action. But we did not. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost the will. And during this period, United States governmental officials began to brainwash the American public. John Foster Dulles assiduously sought to prove that Indochina was essential to our security against the Chinese communist peril. When a negotiated settlement of the war was reached in 1954 through the Geneva Accord, it was done against our will. After doing all that we could to sabotage the planning for the Geneva Accord, we finally refused to sign it. Soon after this, we helped install Premier Diem. We supported him in his betrayal of the Geneva Accord and his refusal to have the promised 1956 election. We watched with approval as he engaged in ruthless and bloody persecution of all opposition forces. When Diem's infamous actions finally led to the formation of the National Liberation Front, the American public was duped into believing that the civil rebellion was being waged by puppets from Hanoi. As Douglas Pike wrote, "And horrid Americans helplessly watched Diem tear apart the fabric of Vietnamese society more effectively than the communists had ever been able to do. It was the most efficient act of his entire career. Since Diem's death, we have actively supported another dozen military dictatorships, all in the name of fighting for freedom." When it became evident that these regimes could not defeat the Viet Cong, we began steadily to increase our forces, calling them military advisors rather than soldiers. Today, we are fighting an all-out war, undeclared by Congress. We have well over 300,000 American servicemen fighting in that benighted and unhappy country. American planes are bombing the territory of another country, and we are committing atrocities equal to any perpetrated by the Viet Cong. This is the third largest war in American history. All of this reveals that we are in an untenable position, morally and politically. We are left standing before the world glutted by our own barbarity. We are engaged in a war that seeks to turn the clock of history back and perpetuate white colonialism. And the greatest irony and tragedy of it all is that our nation, which initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world, is now cast in the mold of being an arch anti-revolutionary. A third casualty of the war in Vietnam is the Great Society. This confused war has played havoc with our domestic destinies. Despite feeble protestations to the contrary, the promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam. The pursuit of this widened war has narrowed domestic welfare programs, making the poor white and Negro bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. And while the anti-poverty program is cautiously initiated, zealously supervised and evaluated for immediate results, billions are liberally expended for this ill-considered war. The recently revealed misestimate of the war budget amounts to $10 billion for a single year. This error alone is more than five times the amount committed to anti-poverty programs. The security we profess to seek in foreign adventures, we will lose in our decaying cities. The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the hopes and possibilities for a decent America. If we reversed investments and gave the armed forces the anti-poverty budget, the generals could be forgiven if they walked off the battlefield in disgust. Poverty, urban problems, and social progress generally are ignored when the guns of war become a national obsession, when it is not our security that is at stake, but questionable and vague commitments to reactionary regimes. Values disintegrate into foolish and adolescent slogans. It is estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. We have escalated the war in Vietnam and de-escalated the skirmish against poverty. It challenges the imagination to contemplate what lives we could transform if we were to cease killing. At this moment in history, it is irrefutable that our world prestige is pathetically frail. Our war policy excites pronounced contempt and aversion virtually everywhere. Even when some national governments, for reasons of economic and diplomatic interest, do not condemn us, their people, in surprising measure, have made clear they do not share the official policy. We are isolated in our false values. In a world demanding social and economic justice, we must undergo a vigorous reordering of our national priorities. A fourth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the humility of our nation. Through rugged determination, scientific and technological progress, and dazzling achievements, America has become the richest and most powerful nation in the world. We have built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We have built gargantuan bridges to span the seas and gigantic buildings to kiss the skies. Through our airplanes and spaceships, we have dwarfed distance and placed time in change. And through our submarines, we have penetrated oceanic depths. This year, our national gross product will reach the astounding figure of $780 billion. All of this is a staggering picture of our great power. But honesty impels me to admit that our power has often made us arrogant as a nation. We feel that our money can do anything. We arrogantly feel that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them.
We often arrogantly feel that we have some divine messianic mission to police the whole world. We are arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same growing pains, turbulence, and revolution that characterized our history. We are arrogant in our contention that we have some sacred mission to protect people from totalitarian rule, while we make little use of our power to end the evils of South Africa and Rhodesia, and while we in fact support dictatorships with guns and money under the guise of fighting communism. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for war in Vietnam. And these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. Of all the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad, he has twice that of whites. And thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and he has half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The rate of infant mortality among Negroes is double that of whites. There were twice as many Negroes in combat in Vietnam at the beginning of 1967, and twice as many died in action in proportion to their numbers in the population as whites. All of this reveals that our nation has not yet used its vast resources of power to end the long night of poverty, racism, and man's inhumanity to man. Enlarged power means enlarged peril, if that is not concomitant growth of the soul. Genuine power is the right use of strength. If our nation's strength is not used responsibly and with restraint, it will be following Lord Acton's dictum, power that tends to corrupt, and power that corrupts an absolute power that corrupts absolutely. Our arrogance can be our doom. It can bring the curtains down on our national drama. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. We are challenged in these turbulent days to use our power to speed up the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough place is plain. A fifth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of dissent. An ugly, repressive sentiment to silence peace seekers depicts advocates of immediate negotiation under terms of the Geneva Agreement and persons who call for a cessation of bombings in the North as quasi-traitors, fools, or venal enemies of our soldiers and institutions. Free speech and the privilege of dissent and discussion are rights being shot down by bombers in Vietnam. When those who stand for peace are so vilified, it is time to consider where we are going and whether free speech has not become one of the major casualties of the war. Curtailment of free speech is rationalized on grounds that a more compelling American tradition forbids criticism of the government when the nation is at war. More than a century ago, when we were in a declared state of war with Mexico, a first-term congressman by the name of Abraham Lincoln stood in the halls of Congress and fearlessly denounced that war. Congressman Abraham Lincoln of Illinois had not heard of this tradition, or he was not inclined to respect it. Nor had Thoreau and Emerson, and many other philosophers who shaped our democratic principles, nothing can be more destructive of our fundamental democratic traditions than the vicious effort to silence dissenters. A sixth casualty of the war in Vietnam is the prospects of mankind's survival. This war has created the climate for greater armament and further expansion of destructive nuclear power. One of the most persistent ambiguities that we face is that everybody talks about peace as a goal. However, it does not take sharpest-eyed sophistication to discern that while everybody talks about peace, peace has become practically nobody's business among the power wielders. Call the roll of those who sing the glad tidings of peace, and one's ears will be surprised by the responding sounds. The heads of all of the nations issue clarion calls for peace, yet these destiny determiners come accompanied by a band and a brigade of national choristers, each bearing unsheathed swords rather than olive branches. The stages of history are replete with the chants and choruses of the conquerors of old who came killing in pursuit of peace. Alexander, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Charlemagne, and Napoleon were akin in their seeking a peaceful world, a world fashioned after their selfish conceptions of an ideal existence. Each sought a world at peace which would personify their egotistic dream. Even within the lifespan of most of us, another megalomaniac strode across the stage of history. He sent his troops blazing across Europe, bringing havoc and Holocaust in his wake. That is grave irony in the fact that Hitler could come forth following the nakedly aggressive expansionist theories he revealed in Mein Kampf and do it all in the name of peace. So when I see in this day the leaders of nations similarly talking peace while preparing for war, I take frightful pause. When I see our country today intervening in what is basically a civil war, destroying hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese children and adults with napalm, and sending home half men mutilated mentally and physically. When I see the recalcitrant unwillingness of our government to create the atmosphere for a negotiated settlement of this awful conflict by halting bombings in the north and agreeing to talk with the Viet Cong, and all this in the name of pursuing the goal of peace, I tremble for our world. I do so not only from dire recall of the nightmares wreaked in the wars of yesterday, but also from dreadful realization of today's possible nuclear destructiveness and tomorrow's even more damnable prospects. The past is prophetic in that it asserts loudly that wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. One day we must come to see that peace is not merely the distant goal that we seek, but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. How much longer must we play? How much longer must we play at deadly war games before we heed the plaintive pleas of the unnumbered dead and maimed of past wars? Why can't we at long last grow up and take off our blindfolds, chart new courses, put our hands to the rudder and set sail for the distant destination, the port city of peace? President John F. Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. How true this is. Wisdom born of experience should tell us that war is obsolete. There may have been a time when war served as a negative good by preventing the spread and growth of an evil force, but the destructive power of modern weapons eliminates even the possibility that war may serve as a negative good if we assume that life is worth living and that man has a right to survive. Then we must find an alternative to war. In a day when vehicles hurtle throughout a space and guided ballistic missiles carve highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can claim victory in war. A so-called limited war will leave little more than a calamitous legacy of human suffering, political turmoil, and spiritual disillusionment. A world war, God forbid, will leave only smoldering ashes as a mute testimony of a human race whose folly led inexorably to ultimate death. So if modern man continues to flirt unhesitatingly with war, he will transform his earthly habitat into an inferno such as even the mind of Dante could not imagine. I do not wish to minimize the complexity of the problems that need to be faced in achieving disarmament and peace, but I think it is a fact that we shall not have the will, the courage, and the insight to deal with such matters unless in this field we are prepared to undergo a spiritual and a mental reevaluation, a change of focus, which will enable us to see that the things which seem most real and powerful are indeed now unreal and have come under the sentence of death. We need to make a supreme effort to generate the readiness, indeed the eagerness, to enter into the new world which is now possible. We will not build a peaceful world by following a negative path. It is not enough to say we must not wage war. It is necessary to love peace and sacrifice for it. We must concentrate not merely on the negative expulsion of war, but on the positive affirmation of peace. That is a fascinating little story that is preserved for us in Greek literature about Ulysses and the sirens. The sirens had the ability to sing so sweetly that sailors could not resist steering toward their island. Many ships were lured upon the rocks, and men forgot home, duty, and honor as they flung themselves into the sea to be embraced by the arms that drew them down to death. Ulysses, determined not to be lured by the sirens, first decided to tie himself tightly to the mast of his boat, and his crew stuffed their ears with wax. But finally, he and his crew learned a better way to save themselves. They took on board the beautiful singer Orpheus, whose melodies were sweeter than the music of the sirens. When Orpheus sang, who bothered to listen to the sirens? So we must fix our vision not merely on the negative expulsion of war, but upon the positive affirmation of peace. We must see that peace represents a sweeter music, a cosmic melody that is far superior to the discords of war. Somehow we must transform the dynamics of the world power struggle from the negative nuclear arms race, which no one can win, to a positive contest to harness man's creative genius for the purpose of making peace and prosperity a reality for all of the nations of the world. In short, we must shift from the arms race into a peace race, if we have the will and determination to mount such a peace offensive. We will unlock hitherto tightly sealed doors of hope and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. Let me say finally that I oppose the war in Vietnam because I love America. I speak out against it not in anger, but with anxiety and sorrow in my heart, and above all with a passionate desire to see our beloved country stand as the moral example of the world. I speak out against this war because I am disappointed with America. There can be no great disappointment where there is not great love. I am disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. Jesus once told a parable of a young man who left home and wandered into a far country, where in adventure after adventure and sensation after sensation, he sought life, but he never found it. He found only frustration and bewilderment. The further he moved from his father's house, the closer he came to the house of despair. The more he did what he liked, the less he liked what he did. After the boy had wasted all, the famine developed in the land, and he ended up seeking food in a pig's trough. But the story does not end there. It goes on to say that in this state of disillusionment, blinding frustration and homesickness, the boy came to himself and said, I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. The prodigal son was not himself when he left the father's house, or when he dreamed that pleasure was the end of life. Only when he made up his mind to go home and be a son again did he really come to himself. The parable ends with the boy returning home to find the loving father waiting with outstretched arms and a heart filled with unutterable joy. This is an analogy of what America confronts today. Like all human analogies, it is imperfect, but it does suggest some parallels worth considering. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. The home that all too many Americans left was solidly structured idealistically. Its pillars were soundly grounded in the insights of our Judeo-Christian heritage. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away, and this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It has driven wisdom from her sacred throne. And this long and callous sojourn in the far country to racism and militarism has brought a moral and spiritual famine to the nation. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to return to her true home of brotherhood and peaceful pursuits. We cannot remain silent. As our nation engages in one of history's most cruel and senseless wars, America must continue to have, during these days of human travail, a company of creative dissenters. We need them because the thunder of their fearless voices will be the only sound stronger than the blast of bombs and the clamor of war hysteria. Those of us who love peace must organize effectively as the war hawks. As they spread the propaganda of war, we must spread the propaganda of peace. We must combine the fervor of the civil rights movement with the peace movement. We must demonstrate, teach, and preach until the very foundations of our nation are shaken. We must work unceasingly to lift this nation that we love to a higher destiny, to a new plateau of compassion, to a more noble expression of humaneness. I have tried to be honest today. To be honest is to confront the truth. To be honest is to realize that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of convenience and moments of comfort, but where he stands in moments of challenge and moments of controversy. However unpleasant and inconvenient the truth may be, I believe we must expose and face it if we are to achieve a better quality of American life. Just the other day, the distinguished American historian Henry Steele Cominger told the Senate Committee, and I quote, "Justice Holmes used to say that the first lesson a judge had to learn was that he was not God. We do tend, perhaps more than other nations, to transfer our wars into crusades. Our current involvement in Vietnam is cast increasingly into a moral mold. It is my feeling that we do not have the resources, material, intellectual, or moral, to be at once an American power, a European power, and an Asian power." I agree with Mr. Cominger, and I would suggest that that is another kind of power that America can and should be. It is a moral power, a power harnessed to the service of peace and human beings, not an inhuman power unleashed against defenseless people. All of the world knows that America is a great military power. We need not be diligent in seeking to prove it. We must now show the world our moral power. That is an element of urgency in our redirecting American power. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant in every plea. It rushes on. Over the bleached bones and cluttered wreckage of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, "Too late." There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today: nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. History will record the choice we make. It is still not too late to make the proper choice. If we too decide to become a moral power, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of this world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. If we make the wise decision, we will be able to transform our pending national and cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. This will be a glorious day. If we will only do it, we will speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, Easterners and Westerners, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And, of course, we are here. We're here on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. 3 years ago today, on April 4th of 1968. And right now we're going to move on and deal with the nation as it unfolded in the news media at the time. And we're going to listen to some reports from April 4th of 1968. Let's listen then.
From the WCTO Radio News Bulletin, this bulletin just in, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not immediately known. Once again, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not immediately known. Stay tuned to WCCO Radio for further details.
The 620 Sports is brought to you by Swanberg and Chevy Buick.
We'll have the weather with Dick Enroth in just a moment. Further details on the Dr. Martin Luther King incident now. King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition was not known immediately. Police put out a wanted bulletin for what they described as a young white male, well-dressed. They said the man was seen running from a brick building across the street. The shooting took place near the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, where King's car was parked. Police said King was sitting in his car when the shot was fired. Officers raced to the scene and surrounded the car. Other units roared into the area and surrounded the hotel. Early reports indicate police had recovered the weapon used in that shooting. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, leading garbage strike marches. His march last Wednesday burst into violence that left one dead, 62 injured, and 200 arrested, and he had planned another mass march for next Monday. Police said the assailant dropped the weapon while running down the main street about one block from the shooting. They said the assailant apparently jumped into a late model car after the shooting and sped away. The Dr. Martin Luther King shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon, and as yet his condition not immediately known. Stay tuned to CCO Radio for further developments on that story. Now the weather story, official weather.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was shot at a downtown Memphis hotel shortly before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this evening. A direct report now from Memphis, Frank Gardner of WREC reporting.
Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot and wounded, possibly critically wounded, in Memphis, Tennessee this evening. Police describe a young, well-dressed, medium-built white male driving a white Mustang, shot at and wounded, possibly critically wounded, Dr. Martin Luther King at his motel room in the downtown area of Memphis this evening. Dr. King reportedly was hit in the face. The extent of his injuries are not known at this moment, but one observer at the hospital, at St. Joseph's Hospital here in Memphis, told this reporter Dr. King apparently had been hit and was wounded badly. He was hit in the face and at last report was being given oxygen. He entered the hospital emergency room with his face covered with a towel. The exact extent of his injuries not known at this time. Apparently, the man responsible for the shooting of Dr. King here in Memphis this evening has not been apprehended. This is Frank Gardner in Memphis.
A hospital spokesman has told CBS News that the condition of Dr. Martin Luther King is critical. This is CBS News in New York.
This is your good neighbor to the Northwest with studios, St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830-WCCO. Once again, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot outside a Memphis hotel this afternoon. His condition now reported as critical. Stay tuned to WCCO Radio for further details. We'll have Music on the Go coming up in just 5 minutes. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King has been shot in a downtown Memphis hotel. Police say that King was removed from the hotel where he was shot and taken by ambulance to a Memphis hospital. No immediate word on the extent of his injuries. However, CBS Radio just a short time ago reported his condition as critical. And that shooting occurred shortly before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Police put out a wanted bulletin for what they described as a young white male, well-dressed. And they said the man was seen running from a brick building just across the street. That shooting, by the way, took place near the Lorraine Hotel in Memphis, where King's car was parked. Police say that King was sitting in his car when the shot was fired. The officers raced to the scene and surrounded the car. Other units then surrounded the hotel. And early reports indicate the police had recovered the weapon used in the shooting. The man apparently dropped the weapon after running and then jumping into a late model car and speeding away. So that is the latest word on the Dr. Martin Luther King shooting in downtown Memphis, Tennessee. And we'll keep you right up to date on that story. We've had so many late-breaking developments here in the last week. And you'll hear all the news, complete, authoritative, and concise, right here on 830-WCCO.
Checking the tread depths on tires, chemically analyzing transmission fluids, and determining the accuracy of speedometer.
Now this late bulletin from the WCCO Radio News Bureau. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., 1964 Nobel Peace Prize winner, and America's leading exponent of nonviolence in the civil rights struggle, was shot to death Thursday night, according to Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux. This just into our WCCO Radio News Bureau. Dr. Martin Luther King apparently shot in the back of the neck while standing on his hotel balcony late today in Memphis, Tennessee. Police rushed to the civil rights leader and then rushed him to a hospital in critical condition. And the word just in now that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Nobel Peace Prize winner, has died in Memphis, Tennessee. Keep tuned to WCCO Radio for further developments. The time now is 20 minutes after 7 o'clock. In the Twin Cities, we have 33.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin. This is Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee, after being shot in the face by an unknown assailant on the balcony in front of a downtown hotel a short while ago. Associated Press says Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux of Memphis confirmed Dr. King's death. Reverend Dr. King, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to lead demonstrations in sympathy with a prolonged strike by municipal garbage men, most of them Negro. Police at last report were still looking for a young white male who was seen running from the scene of the shooting and reportedly dropped the weapon in flight. Frank Gardner, a reporter for CBS station WREC in Memphis, speaks of talking with a surgeon at the hospital who has been in contact moments before with an associate of Dr. King who was in the pediatrics division of the hospital. The surgeon, who was a friend of the other doctor, said they told him that Dr. King died about 15 minutes ago. We repeat, Dr. Martin Luther King, America's nonviolent civil rights leader, shot and killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. At this time, we resume the regular program schedule from other studios on this CBS Radio Net Alert station.
You can take Salem out of the country, but...
The news is breaking fast, and you're right there with CBS Radio Net Alert and WCCO Radio, where you hear history as it happens. Unfortunately, some rather bad history tonight. We'll keep you abreast of late developments here on CCO Radio. 23 minutes now past 7 in the Twin Cities, 30 degrees. Simon and Garfunkel. Dr. Martin Luther King was shot to death in Memphis tonight. The news of King's death was announced by Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux. King was shot as he stood on the balcony of a Memphis motel where he was staying. Police say two unidentified men were taken into custody several blocks from where King was shot. The executive vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Reverend Andrew Young, says the shot hit King in the neck and the lower part of his face. And Young added, he didn't say a word. He didn't move. King was rushed to St. Joseph's Hospital immediately after the shooting, and he was declared dead at the hospital a short time later. Late news from Memphis, Tennessee this evening. Some very, very bad news. In the sports scene tonight, from Studio St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830, this is WCCO. And now the world tonight with Gary Shepard.
This is Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York. Civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King died tonight in Memphis, Tennessee, after being shot in the face by an unknown assailant on the balcony in front of a downtown hotel a short while ago. Associated Press says Assistant Police Chief Henry Lux of Memphis confirmed Dr. King's death. Reverend Dr. King, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, was 39 years old. He was in Memphis to lead demonstrations in sympathy with a prolonged strike by municipal garbage men, most of them Negro. Police at last report were still looking for a young white male who was seen running from the scene of the shooting and reportedly dropped a weapon in flight. Frank Gardner, a reporter for CBS station WREC in Memphis, speaks of talking with a surgeon at the hospital who has been in contact moments before with an associate of Dr. King who is in the pediatrics division of the hospital. The surgeon, who was a friend of the other doctor, said they told him that Dr. King died about 15 minutes ago. We repeat, Dr. Martin Luther King, America's nonviolent civil rights leader, shot and killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. Gary Shepard, CBS News, New York.
The world tonight will continue in a moment.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington. The Reverend Martin Luther King has been shot and killed in Memphis, shot as he stood alone on the balcony of his hotel, and he died soon afterward in the hospital. We are now standing by at the White House for a statement expected momentarily from President Johnson. And while we wait for him to appear in the rain-swept streets in front of the White House, delaying his own arrival at a dinner for congressional Democrats, We will give you some of the details. The police in Memphis have issued a bulletin for a young white man who was seen darting out of the building across the street from the hotel where the Reverend Martin Luther King was staying. Dr. King's chauffeur said that he was standing on the street when Dr. King strolled out onto the second floor balcony moments before he was to leave for dinner at the home of the Reverend Billy Kyles, a Negro minister. Jones, the chauffeur, said that King told me to stop the car. He was ready to go to dinner. I said to the chauffeur, "It's cold outside, Dr. King. Put your top coat on." And he said, "Okay, I will," and he smiled. And those were his last words. "I heard the gun," said the chauffeur. Dr. King fell on his back. He had been looking directly at the man. The identity of the man is still not known. There have been reports that two white persons have been picked up. It is not clear from these wire service reports whether they had any connection with the assassination. The Reverend Andrew Young, who is the executive vice president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was headed by Dr. King and which was planning a march on Washington on April 22nd on behalf of poor people, said that the shot hit Dr. King in the neck and the lower right part of his face. Dr. Young said he didn't say a word. He didn't move. Immediately after the shooting, the civil rights leader was rushed to St. Joseph Hospital, where he was declared dead a short time later. Police armed with rifles have blocked the front entrance to the hospital to hold back a crowd which gathered there quickly. Dr. King had come to Memphis only yesterday to take charge of the continuing demonstrations in support of the city's striking garbage collectors. A march which Dr. King had led last Thursday erupted into rioting in which one person was killed. And now Dr. King had planned another march for next Monday. National Guard troops have rushed to Memphis to quell last week's riot, but they have not been on hand since. Governor Ellington has been alerted that Dr. King was shot, and he was conferring with Memphis authorities and state officials. No decision was announced immediately on whether the National Guard would be returned to Memphis. As we reported previously, the police in Memphis have put out a wanted bulletin for a young white male, well-dressed, who was seen running from a brick building across the street from the hotel where Dr. King's car was parked at the time of the shooting. It is now reported that police have been chasing a late model blue car through Memphis and north to nearby Millington. They reported a civilian in a car with a citizen's band radio had closed on the car and had opened fire on it. The microphones have been set up in front of the door to the White House, and a White House aide has said that President Johnson will come out momentarily to make what is expected to be his statement on what is perhaps the most tragic assassination since the assassination of President Kennedy. We were speaking earlier to the office of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, here in Washington, which was planning the Poor People's March on Washington for April 2nd, where they reported that they were in a state of such shock that they would not comment immediately. Stokely Carmichael, the head of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, had planned a news conference for tomorrow, first canceled, and now he says he will go through with the news conference. This is perhaps one of the acts which may help to weld together the divided Negro community. The reports still coming in from Memphis say that the shot fired at Dr. King apparently came from a brick building across the street from the hotel. There were three white males in the car which the police have been pursuing. More than 100 police and sheriff's deputies have sealed off a five-square block area of Memphis around the hotel. Hundreds of spectators have been flooding around the cordon. Here in Washington, the FBI says that it is investigating the shooting at the specific request of Attorney General Ramsey Clark. The reports coming in from Memphis indicate the Negro community in a state of shock. The Reverend W. Herbert Berter said, "Oh my God, oh my God." In Atlanta, the wife of Dr. King prepared to fly to Memphis immediately. "I was just told he had been shot," she said. "The report I got was in the shoulder, and he was in serious condition." Later, it turned out that Dr. King had died in the hospital. It was, incidentally, the same hospital where James Meredith was taken after his ambush wounding in Hernando, Mississippi, south of Memphis in June 1965. Dr. King, as we said, was in Memphis to lead a massive march on Monday to prove, in the face of last week's riot in Memphis, that he could conduct a peaceful march. His attorneys had gone to court on Thursday to challenge a federal court ban on that march. They said that his march would be orderly and peaceful. The arguments, which were being heard by U.S. District Judge Bailey Brown, had continued late into the day. At the request of the city, Judge Brown had issued a temporary restraining order preventing Dr. King, his associates, or other outsiders from staging a march in Memphis. A demonstration led by Dr. King a week ago caused violence or resulted in one death, 62 injuries, and more than 270 arrests. The first comment from the administration here in Washington has come from Vice President Hubert Humphrey. He said tonight that the assassination of Dr. King brings shame to our country. He predicted that the slaying of the civil rights leader will bring new strength to the cause for which Dr. King had fought. The Vice President said, and we quote his statement, "Martin Luther King's death is a tragedy and a sorrow to his family and to our nation. The criminal act that took his life brings shame to our country. An apostle of nonviolence has been the victim of violence. The cause for which he marched and worked will find new strength. The blight of discrimination, poverty, and neglect must be erased from America. An America of full freedom, full and equal opportunity shall be his living memorial." That is a statement of Vice President Humphrey. We are expecting now a statement from President Johnson. That statement, we were told, will come in about 2 minutes from now. As we have reported, the Reverend Martin Luther King has been fatally shot in Memphis. And tonight, with the first statement already issued by Vice President Humphrey, President Johnson has delayed his departure for a Democratic congressional dinner in order to make a statement on his own behalf. The president is scheduled tonight to leave for Honolulu by way of California, where tomorrow he is to confer with former President Eisenhower. In a period of rapid surprises and shocks, this is the latest to disrupt the schedule of the president and the schedules of many of us. The lights glare on the door of the White House. Presidential news assistant Robert Fleming has said that momentarily the president is expected to make a statement. The microphones are set up in the rain. The reporters are waiting. And soon we expect to hear the voice of the president. President Johnson had known Dr. King. They had seen each other often. He had once advised him at a news conference that it would not be wise for him to prepare this march on Washington. It appears now that there is some delay in the president's statement. We will return to hear the president. Meanwhile, this is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington.
At this time, we resume the regular program schedule from other studios on this CBS Radio Net Alert station. This is your good neighbor to the northwest with studios, St. Paul, Minneapolis at 830 WCCO.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News, New York. We now switch you to Washington.
This is Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington. We are awaiting momentarily a statement by President Johnson at the White House on the fatal shooting of Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis. Dr. King was shot as he stood on a hotel balcony as he was preparing to go out for dinner. At the White House, the microphones have been set up. There are floodlights on the door, and President Johnson is now about to appear.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence. I pray that his family can find comfort in the memory of all he tried to do for the land he loved so well. I have just conveyed the sympathy of Ms. Johnson, myself, to his widow, Mrs. King. I know that every American of goodwill joins me in mourning the death of this outstanding leader and in praying for peace and understanding throughout this land. We can achieve nothing by lawlessness and divisiveness among the American people. It's only by joining together and only by working together can we continue to move toward equality and fulfillment for all of our people. I hope that all Americans tonight will search their hearts as they ponder this most tragic incident. I have canceled my plans for the evening. I am postponing my trip to Hawaii until tomorrow. Thank you.
President Johnson speaking from the White House. The plan that he canceled was his plan to attend a Democratic congressional dinner here in Washington tonight. And as you heard, he will delay his trip to Hawaii tomorrow, but apparently still intends to go to Honolulu for his meeting with American leaders coming in from Saigon. That was the President of the United States on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Daniel Shore, CBS News, Washington.
Welcome back. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. And we just listened to archival news reports from April 4th of 1968 from CBS Radio News on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was quite interesting that there was no mention of the fact that Lyndon Johnson, the then President of the United States, had been estranged from Dr. Martin Luther King due to King's position on the Vietnam War, being in opposition to the Vietnam War, which was the earlier address that we played here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, this special edition of our program. And, of course, Johnson imploring to reject violence, although the war was raging against the Vietnamese people as well as against the oppressed people here in the United States on April 4th of 1968. Right now we want to move into additional news reports. This is from the following day, April 5th of 1968. These reports deal with the response to the assassination of Martin Luther King in many cities. There was a rebellion, which unfolded over the next several days. Let's listen in.
This is Douglas Edwards, CBS News in New York, with a special report on Martin Luther King, The Aftermath. This is the day after Martin Luther King died, and the American Negro community is clearly angry, often uncontrollably angry, over his murder. In the CBS newsroom in New York, it's difficult to keep track of all the cities where sporadic violence has occurred in Negro sections since the bullet of the unknown white gunman cut down the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in Memphis, Tennessee, yesterday. Let's begin this special report with a look at those places where the disturbances seem most severe. The CBS radio affiliate in Chicago, WBBM, reports five people dead from burns and bullet wounds in an outbreak of arson, sniping, and looting, mainly on the Negro West Side. CBS newsman Jed Duval saw the Chicago story unfold today.
It began this morning in Chicago when thousands of Negro schoolchildren failed to show up for classes, an apparent reaction to the slaying of Dr. King. And now it has come to this. The incessant and urgent chatter heard on the two-way radio of a fire engine parked in the heart of the burning and looting on Chicago's West Side. Perhaps half the fire engines in this city are out fighting fires in a 16-block area. Through the day, the children who stayed out of school roamed the large, dismal, crowded black sections of Chicago. More and more often through the early afternoon, windows of stores were broken. Police were challenged and taunted. During the evening rush hour, it became a full-blown riot. Looting reports came in one on top of another. On Warren Street, we watched a young man carrying a shopping bag stuffed with fresh meat, steaks. He stumbled, spilling the bag to the pavement, nearly at the foot of a police officer. Neither the officer nor the looter paid any attention to the other. The loot was scooped up, and the youth walked away. Restaurants and stores throughout the city closed early. Many office workers, apparently sensing trouble, went home in mid-afternoon. Shortly after dark, the olive drab of the Illinois National Guard was first seen on the streets in the riot area. 6,000 guardsmen had been alerted during the afternoon as the vandalism and looting reached alarming proportions. By the time Mayor Daley was on television appealing for calm and order, several buildings on West Madison Street were ablaze. Countless scores of stores all over the city had been looted. One factor on the side of the police is the cool weather. Chicago expects lows in the 20s tonight, and that might help. It's much colder than it will be in July. Jed Duval, CBS News, Chicago.
Police in Detroit report an 18-year-old Negro youth was shot and killed tonight while being arrested with 19 other youths for what the police describe as looting. For the general picture in Detroit, site of the worst riot in the nation's history last summer, here's Jim McQuarrie of CBS radio affiliate WJR.
Listening to police radios here in Detroit, one is jerked backward in time to the humid July days of last year when the nation's worst riot was in progress. The significant difference this time, the city police, state police, and National Guardsmen are on the job at the very beginning. Last night, Detroit, like all American cities, was too numb to act or react to news of Dr. King's death. Today, some overreaction. At mid-morning, the first violent acts were reported as small gangs of youths roamed the still riot-scarred sections of Detroit, throwing bricks, bottles, and rocks through windows. The activity was unorganized, and there were no injuries at that time. Early this morning, squads of state troopers moved into Detroit to beef up the city police. Detroit Mayor Jerome Cavanaugh declared a state of emergency this afternoon and clamped a curfew of 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. on the city. Sales of liquor and gasoline were stopped. At this hour, one accidental shooting in suburban Highland Park as police were arresting looters. There have been three non-fatal shootings, one policeman injured, and four civilians. No details are being released other than the cold statistics. Governor Romney flew into Detroit late this afternoon. Tonight, he and Mayor Cavanaugh toured Detroit and both agreed that the preventive police and National Guard effort has been successful in buttoning down large-scale violence, at least up to this point in time. There is still the weekend to come. This is Jim McQuarrie in Detroit.
Some of the worst trouble of the day occurred in Washington, D.C., the very heart of the nation. Tonight, the White House and the Capitol are surrounded by federal troops. They were brought in on the orders of President Johnson. For a late report on the situation in Washington, we go to CBS newsman Tony Sargent.
At least 4,000 National Guard and federal troops are in this uneasy town tonight, and more stand ready. Most are equipped with M16 rifles, helmets, and gas masks. Some tanks have been brought in. 1,000 city police are on duty. In many of these streets, the troops and police are the only visible figures, but in others, looters still roam, adding to the so far uncounted number of items hauled from broken store windows in this town starting as early as midday, as close as two blocks from the White House. At least 100 fires have been ignited. Several are burning out of control at this hour, but overall the fires are diminishing. One just opposite me, here in the Negro part of town, is now being brought gradually under control by Washington firefighters. Police report having made more than 600 arrests, with over half these still in custody. Three deaths have been reported so far. Walter Washington, the mayor of this city, imposed a curfew at 5:30. As that curfew fell, thousands of motorists were choking the streets, heading towards suburban homes, weekend holidays, or just outward for the sake of it. The tourists have also been leaving in droves. Airlines report jammed ticket counters. One thing they came here for has been nipped in the bud by these riots. The annual Cherry Blossom Festival that would have climaxed this weekend has been canceled entirely. And even the opening day baseball game, originally set for Monday, now has been postponed at least one day. Tony Sargent, CBS News, in the riot area of Washington.
Memphis, Tennessee is, of course, the focal point. The past 24 hours of tragedy and the ensuing violence began there. And for a late report from the scene, here is CBS News reporter Ed Rabel.
While other American cities are seething with unrest, Memphis, the center of tension following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., has thus far been spared major outbreaks of violence. There are different explanations for the lack of violence here. Police say their show of force is responsible, while Negro leaders credit their influence in the Negro community as the deciding factor. Despite all this, Memphis has had problems. Frank Holloman, the director of public safety in Memphis, made this statement earlier today.
The looting and sniping and arson activities in Memphis has tapered off. It has lessened, although there is some sporadic activities still going on at the present time.
Reports of sporadic looting and rioting are still coming in tonight, but a curfew enforced by 4,000 National Guardsmen and police tactical units is generally being obeyed, and for the most part, Memphis is calm. Ed Rabel, CBS News, Memphis.
The nation's first major riot since World War II took place in Watts, the Negro district of Los Angeles. But that area is generally quiet tonight, as we hear from CBS News correspondent Bill Stout.
One surprise in this day of anguish and turmoil was the reaction in Watts, the Negro ghetto of Los Angeles, scene of the first of the big city riots. A surprise because, so far at least, there has been virtually no trouble. Several schools were dismissed early, some before noon, and thousands of young people crowded the streets and the sidewalks and the parks, but there were no riots, no looting, no cars overturned. An incident here and there, to be sure, but nothing like the bloodbath of 3 years ago. Partly that's due to the restraint of news people and police. Unlike the riot time of 1965, this situation brought no rush of armed officers and cameramen and reporters into the middle of the ghetto. Several investigations since then, from Watts to Harlem and Newark, have produced evidence that news coverage alone can add to the trouble. But this time, the news teams held back, the police held back, and Negro leaders, militants and moderates alike, moved in to try to head off the trouble. So far, thanks to the calming elements and to the people themselves, there has been little or no trouble, though of course it could change in a matter of minutes. Other effects in this area, Senator Eugene McCarthy canceled the rest of his California and Oregon campaign schedule. He'll return to Washington in the morning. And looking ahead to the Oscars, the Academy Awards ceremony Monday evening, four Negro stars have canceled out. Sidney Poitier, Diane Carroll, Sammy Davis Jr., and Louis Armstrong. But all this is precautionary. So far, no violence. Bill Stout, CBS News, Los Angeles.
National Guardsmen were also on alert tonight, or states of emergency declared, in Philadelphia, in Nashville, in the state of Mississippi. The Philadelphia story at last report was only isolated vandalism and scuffling between black and white teenagers, although it's a sad commentary on the passage of Martin Luther King to hear ourselves saying only isolated vandalism. In New York City, it's unexpectedly quiet in the Negro quarters such as Harlem or Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant, but in the Times Square area, crowds of Negroes were reported on the street, smashing windows and looting inside them. The day after Martin Luther King was murdered started with lingering unrest in the nation's Negro ghettos. As it proceeded, there were events sufficient to keep Negro reaction at a fever pitch. Dramatically, the center of attention was still in Memphis, where King's body still lay, and where his top assistant, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, spoke over him in a memorial service.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
The Reverend Abernathy, successor to Martin Luther King at the head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the crowds shuffling past King's coffin.
Abernathy and the crowds followed King's coffin to the airport, where a New York newsman, Tony Brunton of WCBS, recorded Abernathy as he sought to restrain the mourning crowd.
We have pledged to you that we are going to carry his work forward. Now, let us not do anything at this particular time that will discredit his life. He lived so nobly.
We shall overcome.
Go back to
him. We shall overcome.
Crowd moving back now, away from the under the wing of the aircraft at the request of the Reverend Abernathy.
We shall
National Guardsmen, fixed bayonets, behind them helmeted city policemen with shotguns, submachine guns, and rifles, pushing the crowd back from time to time, asking them to move back for their own protection, the police said. Now they have moved back at the request of the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, the man who will be taking over from Dr. King as leader of the Southern Christian Conference. He asked them to move back.
We shall overcome someday.
On the plane, chartered incidentally by New York Senator Robert Kennedy, was a grieving widow waiting to escort her husband's body back home to Atlanta. There were more keening followers at the airport and still more at a downtown funeral parlor where the body was taken to await the funeral. It will probably be next Tuesday with King's father, the Reverend Martin Luther King, Sr., presiding. Back in Memphis, there was still the hunt for the assassin. No one was reported in custody, but law enforcement officials were confident that someone soon would be. Confidence expressed by U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who quickly flew to Memphis from Washington to announce the full resources of the FBI were behind local and state policemen. Clark saw no evidence of a conspiracy. Police have an alarm out for one man, dark hair, medium build, between 26 and 32 years old, and, of course, white. As it was for the average citizen, this was also an upsetting day for President Johnson. There were the necessary rituals proclaiming Sunday a national day of mourning and ordering all flags on U.S. facilities down to half-staff until King is buried. But the day had deeper, more somber meanings for Mr. Johnson. CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint sums up the day from the presidential viewpoint.
Tonight from the front lawn of the White House, he could look one direction and see the dark smoke from the fires billowing overhead, another direction to the red glow of the fires themselves. From the back lawn, he could see the silent soldiers with their so far silent guns. For a president who has done more than any other in recent history for the Negro people, it was a bitter sight at the end of a dismal day. President Johnson sensed the danger last night as soon as word came of Dr. King's death, and he moved to avert it. By dawn, he had a dozen civil rights leaders moving toward the White House for a midday meeting with top administration and political leaders. The president pleaded for calm, and they agreed, but told him action was needed as well. Action long delayed to bring the Negro Americans into their full heritage. The president then announced he would speak to a joint session of Congress Monday night.
We must move with urgency and with resolve and with new energy in the Congress and in the courts and in the White House and the State House and the city halls of the nation. Wherever there is leadership, political leadership, leadership in the churches, in the homes, in the schools, in the institutions of higher learning, until we do overcome.
Late in the afternoon, after the civil rights leaders had left, President Johnson announced he had canceled his trip to Hawaii to plan Vietnam strategy. Instead, General Westmoreland is flying to Washington. Meantime, the violence and the arson and the looting worsened to the point where a saddened president was finally forced to call in federal troops to protect the nation's capital from embittered fellow Americans whom he had tried to help. Robert Pierpoint, CBS News, at the White House.
On the state level, President Johnson was emulated almost to a carbon copy by a man many insist is still a potential Republican candidate for the White House, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller.
Rockefeller appeared on statewide radio and television tonight. He officially proclaimed Sunday a state day of mourning, and he ordered flags on state facilities flown at half staff. He also announced he'd send a special message to the legislature in Albany next Monday, urging swift passage of social welfare bills, saying Americans must redeem their honor not with words, but with deeds.
There will be fighting in our streets so long as there is fighting in our hearts. The black citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace with bricks or guns, only with courage and dignity that he proudly expected from his people. And the white citizens can pay no tribute to this man of peace merely by weeping upon his death, only by honoring, at last and in full, the principles of brotherhood for which he gave his life. I shall send to the state legislature this Monday a special message urging that such deeds quickly become law. There already is before the legislature a series of measures vitally affecting the lives of all our Negro citizens, jobs and health, housing, education and training. The enactment of these measures will give witness to our profound vow, our vow not merely to talk, but to act, so that Martin Luther King's dream of America becomes the life of America.
Robert Kennedy interrupted his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination today, but he did keep a speaking engagement at the Civic Club in Cleveland, not to speak about politics, but instead to denounce the senseless violence that struck Martin Luther King down.
Victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why?
In another part of town, Cleveland's Negro mayor, Carl Stokes, was eulogizing Martin Luther King at a memorial service.
You can kill a man, but you cannot kill an idea. And the idea and the ideals for which Dr. Martin Luther King stood, for which he lived, and for which he died, will continue to live in this country, will continue to live in this city. And despite the sorrow upon under which all of us today feel so heavy, there will on tomorrow be a resurgence of the confidence that he was right, and that we will overcome.
Like many another public official today, Cleveland's Mayor Carl Stokes had tears visible in his eyes as he stood to eulogize the late Reverend Martin Luther King. What comes next? The main moves are probably with President Johnson when he speaks to Congress next Monday night. What will he call for? Another reporter on the CBS News White House beat, correspondent Dan Rather, has some thoughts.
What the president wants to propose to Congress Monday is a great leap forward for social justice. An open housing bill, certainly. But it is spelt here, there must be more than that. Mr. Johnson has been talking to civil rights leaders by the dozens, white and black, but mostly black, in the White House, by telephone, and through intermediaries. The black leaders have many suggestions. Most cost money, much money, and that's the hang-up. Whitney Young, director of the National Urban League, for example, has revived the idea of a domestic Marshall Plan, a huge spending program in decaying urban areas. Jobs and housing, on an unprecedented scale for the black poor. Caught in the fiscal vice formed by spiraling war costs on one side and skyrocketing deficits on the other, Mr. Johnson's options are few. Quick passage of the open housing bill and a stepped-up program for jobs cost the least, they are likely to get the heaviest emphasis in the Monday speech to Congress. Dan Rather, CBS News, the White House.
The wide range of reaction to Dr. King's death generally had one element in common, emotion, indicating this was one of those momentous incidents that hit most of us where we really live. Consider two statements from polar extremes. One from Jacqueline Kennedy in New York, who herself lost a husband to an assassin's bullet. The president's widow says she weeps for Mrs. King and her children and prays we'll now find more room in our hearts for love and justice. Mrs. Kennedy makes it difficult for us to sit passively in self-righteous condemnation of King's assassin when she points out, some people would never kill, but even to speak of another with hatred is the same and causes death. The former First Lady also adds, when will our country learn that to live by the sword is to perish by the sword? This in contrast to Black Power militant Stokely Carmichael, who in Washington today said, white America declared war on black America last night. As Carmichael saw it, there is no need for a lot of intellectual talk now. That's all over. We will wait, but only until we can get enough guns. What is needed now are guns and more guns. The judgment of Stokely Carmichael. The American tragedy of Martin Luther King's murder has brought an outpouring of universal reaction. Pope Paul VI urged calm and respect for the principle of brotherly love. Great Britain's Parliament expressed horror at what it termed this brutal and senseless murder. In Africa, where King was a hero, his assassination brought praise for the man from statesmen and predictions of widespread violence in America's cities. UN Secretary General U Thant, now in Geneva, sent a message of sympathy to Mrs. King. A similar message went to the bereaved widow from Sweden's King Gustav, who presented the Nobel Peace Prize to the civil rights leader back in the year 1964. Another CBS News Washington correspondent, Eric Severide, was one of those with tears in his eyes as he recorded this evaluation of that noted American, Martin Luther King.
We have all been told that we live in a bland and cautious time and are bereft of heroes. We have been told that our generation is as embarrassed in the presence of the noble as our ancestors were embarrassed in the presence of the base. The life of Martin Luther King denies the first assumption. The reaction to his death denies the second. Almost surely, he was the most important American of his time, white or black. He, more than any other man, wielded the cutting edge of history for this time and place. He preached love, so hate, of course, destroyed him, as it destroyed 2,000 years ago the man whose gospel he followed, as it destroyed 20 years ago in India the man whose strategies he adopted. Saints are usually killed by their own people. Dr. King was not. He was not an American Negro. He was a Negro American. As Dr. Abernathy once said of King, he seeks to save the nation and its soul, not just the Negro. King grasped a white man by his shoulder, forced him to turn around and looked long and hard upon his fellow black American. To some, the sight was frightening. To many others, the landscape of our lives looked richer and full of much greater promise. There are those who proclaim that white society killed Dr. King. Democracy cannot function under such a theory. To blame everyone is to blame no one. Only the Hitlers of this world and their spiritual kin, like young Mr. Carmichael, believe in mass guilt and in genocide as justice. There are those who proclaim that this is a sick society. It is a society containing many sick individuals, white and black, including the moral invalid who fired the shot last night. It is doubtful if this nation has ever before gone into officially proclaimed mourning, its flags everywhere at half-staff, over the death of a private citizen. And this man was a descendant of slaves. This is not the reaction of a sick society, but of a fundamentally healthy society trying desperately to cleanse itself of the one chronic, persistent poison in its body. So the label on his life must not be a long day's journey into night. It must be a long night's journey into day. This is Eric Severide in Washington.
Now tonight, the vast majority of Americans, black and white,
or holding their breath and hoping the poison works its way through our systems quickly and as painlessly as possible. As an outspoken voice for civil rights, Negro entertainer Sammy Davis Jr., speaking in New York to CBS News reporter Josh Darsa, was one of those urging moderation on his companions.
I plead, if there's ever been a black brother or a sister that's ever heard me and felt that maybe I had something to say, I beg them to hold their emotions in check. We cannot desecrate what this man stood for. I think that the man who goes out and loots at this point is maybe only two steps lower than the man who shot down King. The black man said to me, I am so angry with my country, I am so upset, and I want to burn down the ghetto that I live in. I can emotionally agree with that. But if he tells me I want to break down a liquor store and loot a liquor store or steal shoes, then I think we're defeating everything that this man stood for. And I think that now is the time for the militant leaders to say, all right, baby, let's hold ourselves. You're angry, you're mad, man. Let's hold it now and see if Whitey's going to come up with it.
Will Whitey come up with it, and will U.S. Negroes wait until he does? These the questions black and white Americans are asking tonight, both factions poorer, now that Martin Luther King is no longer around to help find a peaceful...
Oh, welcome back, and that was reports from CBS that were broadcast live on April the 5th, 1968, just the day after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we're going to close out with excerpts from the evening news, CBS Evening News, April 5th of 1968.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Eric Sebride in Washington, Steve Rowan in Washington, Dan Rather at the White House, Ike Pappas in Memphis, Bill Plant in Memphis, Peter Burns in Atlanta, John Hart in Cleveland, and Bert Quint in Khe Sanh, South Vietnam.
Good evening. The body of Dr. Martin Luther King was returned to his home in Atlanta today as authorities in Memphis expressed confidence that his slayer soon will be captured. President Johnson appealed nationally for calm, asking all citizens to deny violence its victory. Nevertheless, the murder sent a shockwave of violence rolling through the big cities of America, and the worst trouble was in Washington, virtually on the president's doorstep. Late today, the president declared a state of emergency, and regular army troops moved into the nation's capital to protect strategic locations from the violence spreading through the city. Steve Rowan reports.
A stiff breeze fanned the flames of more than half a dozen fires set by looters along 7th Street. And the wind quickly dispersed the tear gas used by police in their only attempts to stop the looting. The looters were mostly young Negro men and women, as well as boys down to the age of 6 or 7. They hit the liquor stores first, then went for clothing stores, appliance stores, and other shops. They roamed back and forth across 7th Street, unhindered by the police, cheering as another plate glass window caved in, laughing at each other as they emerged with armloads of loot. There was little talk of Martin Luther King, just an occasional bitter remark from someone, usually someone not involved in the looting, about the white so-and-so who shot the civil rights leader. A few of them were arrested, usually when they ran into the arms of officers with their loot. And as the afternoon wore on, they stripped just about every store along an 8-block stretch of the street, taking more than they could ever use themselves, discarding what didn't fit or wasn't the right color on the sidewalks outside. Half a dozen police cars stood by, and from time to time, a few of the officers would put on their gas masks, take a few canisters of tear gas, and walk up the street, chasing the looters away for a few minutes. But as soon as they passed, the looting continued. From the air, the scene looked unreal.
a row of fires in the middle of an otherwise tranquil city. But everyone knows that this city is not tranquil, that a flare-up of violence has been threatening for years. And Mayor Walter Washington moved this afternoon to prevent real violence, real bloodshed, by imposing a curfew on Washington from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. This was to have been the weekend for Washington's Cherry Blossom Festival, but all the events of that annual celebration were canceled. A few Negroes complained of police violence, but there was little of it. The officers did take a number of Negroes into police custody, arrested them in the act of looting. As the afternoon wore on, one policeman took off his gas mask, looked around, and asked if the National Guard had been called. "We need them," he said. "We can't hold this tonight. We're losing." And indeed, the city of Washington lost much this afternoon. But the troops were called in late in the day, arriving near the White House, from which point they'll fan out. Steve Rowan, CBS News, Washington.
The violence was by no means limited to Washington. Detroit tonight is under a curfew, and National Guard troops are on duty there. Guardsmen also have been mobilized in Chicago, where five blocks of predominantly Negro West Madison Avenue were reported to fire, and where looting broke out in the downtown Loop area. And in Boston, where a menacing crowd of young Negroes kept customers trapped in a supermarket for a time. The Guard also is on duty in three cities in North Carolina and two in Tennessee. Last night or today, racial trouble also broke out in such widespread locations as Denver, Colorado, Oakland, California, and Buffalo, New York. At least four persons have been killed in the outbursts, and countless more injured or arrested.
Black & Decker dealers are having a special spring sale. There are irresistible values on jigsaws that cut wood, metal, and plastic. There are big savings on circular saws that do anything a handsaw can do. Better, faster.
Oh, come on.
There are special deals on dual-action sanders for finishing and refinishing beautifully.
That's better.
The Black & Decker label assures you of the finest power tools made. Spring will be a little great this year.
For Cousin Tom, for Uncle Don, for your boss.
Men who work with power tools know, for value, performance, and service, you can expect the best from Black & Decker.
The crisis in race relations shoved the Vietnam War into the background at the White House today, and President Johnson devoted almost all his time to the problem. CBS News White House correspondent Dan Rather reports.
The president canceled plans for a Vietnam strategy conference in Honolulu. General Westmoreland will be in Washington tomorrow instead. Mr. Johnson requested a joint session of Congress for Monday night to discuss civil justice. He proclaimed Sunday a national day of mourning and prayer. These actions followed in rapid succession a White House meeting this morning. The president and 21 of the nation's best-known civil rights leaders. Dr. King's father was invited but could not attend. He sent word he joined the president in calling for law and order. The assembled civil rights leaders went with the president to a memorial service at National Cathedral. The cathedral memorial service was packed. The president's mood was somber and serious all day, before, during, and after his appearance at the cathedral. Back at the White House, Mr. Johnson met again with the civil rights leaders, Chief Justice Warren and House Speaker McCormick included. Negro leaders stated bluntly what they thought should be done: rapid, positive civil rights legislation and spending. The president said bluntly that a continuation of divisiveness and violence would be nothing less than a national catastrophe.
The dream of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. has not died with him. Men who are white, men who are black, must and will now join together as never in the past
to let all the forces of divisiveness know that America shall not be ruled by the bullet, but only by the ballot of free and of just men.
Shortly after the president spoke, black smoke from riot fires in downtown Washington drifted over the White House and its half-mast flag. Dan Rather, CBS News, at the White House.
Attorney General Ramsey Clark in Memphis said the murder appears to have been the work of one man and there is no evidence of conspiracy. Without elaboration, he said the investigation has spread several hundred miles beyond Tennessee and authorities are very close to an arrest. The fatal shot came from a boarding house across the street from the hotel balcony where Dr. King was standing alone last night. This photograph was made Wednesday. The landlady described the suspect as a white man who registered as John Willard and who had what she described as a silly smile I'll never forget. For film reports, we go to Ike Pappas and Bill Plant in Memphis and Peter Burns in Atlanta. First, Pappas.
Eyewitnesses to the assassination say that Dr. King left his room, 306, at the Lorraine Hotel just before dinner to get some air. He walked over to the railing at this spot, and noticing some friends below, he leaned over and began to speak with them. Police say 205 feet away, in a window in a flophouse, the assassin waited.
Leaning forward to brace his arms on the window ledge to steady his rifle. And this was his view. He fired a single shot that hit its target squarely, and then he ran. Down the hallway and along the decrepit stairs, turning, he raced out to the street. And as one policeman said, he simply faded.
Just at 8 this morning, Dr. Martin Luther King's body was brought to Lyon State for an hour. Hundreds paid their respects during that brief hour. They were old. They were dressed for work. They were almost all black. And for some of them, the experience was just too much. Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Dr. King's closest friend in life.
Even forevermore, I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
The plane had come from Atlanta, bearing Mrs. King. There were police and National Guardsmen at the airport with rifles and shotguns and riot sticks to hold back the crowd of newsmen and spectators. After some delay, the casket was placed aboard for the last journey home to Atlanta. And late today, a judge in Memphis approved the march which Martin Luther King had planned to lead next Monday. Bill Plant, CBS News, Memphis.
Militants and non-militants stood quietly as Dr. King's wife and four children left the plane for a limousine. The rains had stopped just before the plane arrived. Mayor Allen led the motorcade from the airport through downtown Atlanta to a funeral home just a few blocks from the gold-domed state capitol. And another crowd of 500 waited there. Mrs. King took the children into the home. She met with friends and family to make plans for the funeral. His brother, Reverend A.D. King, came here from Louisville. The acting president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, spoke to the people.
He was a man that did not believe in violence. He
yes,
believed
sir.
In nonviolence.
Yes, sir.
He lived this, he preached this, and this is the way he died.
Family sources indicate that funeral services will probably be held on Tuesday in Dr. King's father's church here. Peter Burns, CBS News, Atlanta.
With the death of Dr. King, his longtime aide and close friend, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, becomes head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Abernathy pledged today to continue to follow the nonviolent philosophy that dominated Dr. King's civil rights activity.
Yum, yum, yum.
Cool Whip.
It's new. The first modern topping with that good old-fashioned taste.
Welcome back. And those were archived news reports from CBS on April 4th and April 5th of 1968. And of course, in future programs, we'll go into more of an in-depth analysis of the role of the U.S. government and other right-wing elements in the United States in the assassination of Dr. King. Of course, the official announcements conceal the animosity towards Dr. King by official circles in the United States due to his opposition to the Vietnam War, his efforts to link the civil rights movement, the burgeoning youth movement in the urban areas to the struggle against war and imperialism. And that, of course, is the reason why Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And we're going to be signing off for the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for today, Sunday, April 4th, 2021, this 53rd anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We want to remind our listeners that you can, of course, log on to the Pan-African Newswire at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. You can also, as well, have access to this program, the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast, by logging on to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Programs can be shared with other potential listeners, copying and pasting the links into emails, copying and pasting the links on blogs and websites, as well as sharing the links on social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week.
Hello, welcome to Half an Hour of Jazz, live and direct from the Penthouse on King FM, coming to you live and direct from the Penthouse. Regular weekly feature here from 9:30 to 10 o'clock. Tonight we have Wes Montgomery on guitar, and in the first half of the program featuring the Wynton Kelly Trio.